Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education together. It is 8:05, and present are Representative Keller Munoz, Edgman, Gardner, Book, myself, Seaton. Don't forget your cell phones. Gee, where are those bagels from Eddie? We are today going to take up two items. One is House Bill 367, Tax Credits for Educational Contributions. And then we are also, under bills previously heard and scheduled as well, we had House Bill 206, and we asked some questions of the department to answer on some of the testing levels, so we'll bring that up then. It's not my intention to move that bill today, but we want to get the discussion on the on those testing from folks in assessment. So we'll take House Bill 367, and we've had House Bill 367 introduced. Do we have the CS before us? Is that right? Version E. We adopted the CS. Okay. Is there anything else the sponsor wants to relate to us on this bill at this time before we go to public testimony?
For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Kathy Munoz. There is one thing we did want to point out on this bill. Was the committee had asked some questions in the last hearing that Department of Revenue had provided a six-page document which went over those questions. And I can go over those now or have Robin go over that. Either way, have the chair would prefer. Or if you have any questions on that document, get a chance to take a look at it.
Oh, okay. Was that on our desk today? Was that? Okay. Why don't you go ahead and briefly go through that, and then we'll direct questions to Ms. Roy.
Sure. So I will look key on this. During the last meeting, there were a couple of different things that we had looked at and asked questions about, and one being the contribution for which income tax credit can be claimed, and there was two different scenarios. If you look at attachment one, that runs through on the education tax credit on the column that has a deduction in comparison to the credit and seeing the benefits of each. And as you can tell kind of at the bottom there, they run through just using the 25 million dollar tax credit, which is what the cap is set at. And it's just showing the differences between a deduction and a credit, showing that the value of the credit is much larger than the deduction.
And I just have a question on that. So
sure.
This is showing how a credit and deduction would work. Does it show on here any place the additional, shall we call it an expense to a party, to a corporation that would be making this? In other words, they're going to have to come up with the other 50% of the money out of their corporate circumstance, their corporate profits to put this in. So does that show on this list or not?
No. So I guess what we're looking at on here is if you did the maximum tax credit is what we were looking at. So that's why we just picked the number of 50,000 or 50 million, and then it comes into the tax credit of 25 million. So we either do that as the deduction, which the first one shows, or the credit, where it comes in at the end of it, where the 25 million, where our cap is set at.
Okay, thank you. And I we'll get to Robin and ask her about that later. That's fine. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay. Then attachment two, there are assumptions about comparing the order of credits, and that was another question that was posed by the committee. And we're looking here, what we did was we used two different types of credits, the income tax credit or the film production tax credit. The difference in one of the big differences we wanted to show is that the income tax education credit has no carryover, and unlike some of these other tax credits, like the film production tax credit has a 3-year carryover. So if looking at attachment 2 and also comparing attachment 3, attachment 2 shows that the income tax credit was fully used, which comes out to the tax credits available for future utilization, which will carry over to the next year, is a lot greater than if the income tax credit for education was not used first and that was used second. Your carryover to the next year is going to be lower because the education tax credit was not utilized to its full extent. So those are those two charts that show that out. So if we use the income tax credit first in comparison if we use the second. Attachment 4, we're looking at the credits claimed in FY 7, 8, and 9. That was just a request for the committee, just trying to see what has been utilized in the past. And attachment 5, this is broken down by the type of tax, so for FY 7, 8, and 9 as well. And then the last page are just some suggestions that Department of Revenue had had proposed to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On attachment 5, the note underneath says that the amounts don't include contributions that would have enjoyed the tax credit, but the taxpayer did not claim a credit but claimed a deduction instead.
Mm-hmm.
So under what circumstances does the taxpayer have the choice between a deduction or a credit? Always, or?
Through the Chair, Representative Gardner, yes, I believe they do. Robin can chime into this one, too. But I believe they can choose on whether or not that they want to use the tax credit or they want to go with a deduction.
Thank you.
And am I assuming that that's because there was a limitation of the $150,000 for, or the $200,000 limit on the tax credit, and it was unlimited on a deduction?
That would be my assumption.
Okay. Further questions on these? We can go back and review them later, but I just wanted to get them on the table so that before we had public testimony, if anybody was referring to them, the committee would have seen them and known that they were here. Any further questions of the bill sponsor at this time?
I am online.
Thank you. We'll come back to you in just a minute. And Robin, thank you for letting us know you were there. Let's go to public testimony. We have one person that signed up, Dennis Selfie. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. I'm having trouble reading the.
Okay, don't write as good as they used to. My name is Dennis Steffi. I work for the University of Alaska. We have benefited in my little program several times from the provisions of the bill as it currently exists. Lately, we've been in discussions with various companies about attempting some far more ambitious joint projects between the university and industry. Of course, the limit on the amount of deductions or credits has been not very attractive in the existing sense. I think raising this would allow some of those discussions to go forward on some really major things. Now, I've done this for quite a while, and up through probably the middle of the 80s, our entire vocational education program was based on donations from vendors, from companies, from what we could pick up. So that contribution of the private sector has always been a huge part, I think, of not just my program, but programs throughout the university that we wouldn't be able to function. Problem is today the technology is not the kind of thing that companies can just donate. There needs to be some serious cash money involved in getting our students up to where they're competitive now. So I encourage you to look favorably upon this. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And Dennis, would you just let us know what kind of program with the university that you have? I think you said you're you've been able to fund the program, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm the director of the university's Mining and Petroleum Training Service. We have branches all over the state, wherever the industry is operating. We're down here now for the startup of the Kensington Mine and some attrition over at Greens Creek, but we have a lot of programs throughout the state. And again, they're here because of the cooperation of the industry and their participation. We've done a lot of things that just couldn't be funded any other way. Anything to help that is going to be good for our kids.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Buch had a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, it's more of a comment. In former life, Mr. Steffi and I worked together on some partnerships. At this time, at that time, it was encouragement of oil and gas partnerships between here and Russia, and bringing some of those folks in and interrelating with companies in Alaska. So some of those opportunities, I think, were lost for various reasons, but there are other ones that are always out there. Mr. Steffi's been around for a long time, mostly down on the Kenai Peninsula, and working with various entities all over, at one time, all over the world. So.
And Ms. Steffi, have you been working on the petroleum tech, is it called petroleum processes?
Process tech, you bet. We taught the very first class, 1999, I believe that was. And recently I have, because of press of other business, given that over, and it's I am no longer actively involved in that, although to teach some and help out once in a while. But.
Great, thank you. It's been a wonderful program. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Steffi. Could you speak to some of the infrastructure needs that your program has?
Well, certainly, probably our most pressing issue is deals with people in the minerals industry and the oil and gas industry. That there are some incredibly attractive jobs out there in terms of salary, benefits, working conditions, etc. I continue to be frustrated when I see the number of people that are not Alaskan residents in these jobs. So right here in town, what we're doing now is we have a very kind donation of the Alaska AJ mine property. And we've been down this week rehabilitating it, getting ready to train students for Kensington, Greens Creek, Niblack, and Pogo. Our biggest need right now is to get some of this high technology mining machinery simulators. I no longer can afford to get the actual machinery, put fuel in it, lube it, maintain it. I have got to have a more economical way of preparing people for these jobs, so that's kind of our push this year, to get the portable simulators that we can move around the state from location to location wherever the mines are opening up. Second one is we have a, if we get an expanded offshore industry in this state, speaking principally of Beaufort, Chukchi, some of those regions, we're going to have to very much step up our basic health and safety programs, helicopter abandonment, cold water survival, et cetera, et cetera. We've been talking with the companies about a partnership to put a cold water survival facility probably in Kenai, Soldotna, Homer area, somewhere around the Central Peninsula. That would be about a, we're looking at about $11 million. It looks to me like this, the bill that you're considering would make that form more attractive to the companies that have been talking to us as a way of getting that one off the ground.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Thank you very much for coming in and testifying. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 367? Is there anyone online to testify? Seeing none, I will close testimony on House Bill 367. And Robin Wilson, are you still online?
Yes, certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm here. This is Robin Wilson with the Tax Division.
Thank you, Robin. Looking over the sheets that we have here, were there any comments that you wanted to give us on these or explanations? I guess I was looking at Attachment 1, and I guess at the top it says the purpose is to compare the benefit of a deduction or a credit of $50,000. So, and was I right that in the credit column that, you know, that's looking at the credit, but it was also have another $25,000 that would be coming out of corporate funds to the university in that column?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I think Kendra did a good job of walking through the package that I sent. And as you see there, this does compare the sort of the benefit of a deduction versus a credit, and sort of to put it in a little bit of perspective that maybe folks are perhaps more familiar with. You know, if we think of one federal tax return, it's sort of comparing the benefit you get by paying mortgage interest and deducting that, and then at the end, when you figure out your tax and you're claiming, let's say, a child care credit or an energy credit, that comes off of the tax directly. So in this example here on Attachment 1, I've assumed a contribution of $50 million, and the taxpayer does have a choice of taking either a deduction or a credit, but not both under the current statute. Obviously, the current statute amount is different, but the principle of not taking both a deduction and a credit for the same contribution is already in statute. And so in this example that I've prepared, in the second column, that's where the taxpayer chooses to claim a credit. And so the $25 million is 50% of the actual contribution of 50.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions on Attachment 1 for Ms. Wilson? Seeing none there, do you want to have any other explanations for us on the others? I guess, am I understanding, I was trying to follow when we first went through, but Attachment 2 is a comparison to Attachment 3, is that correct?
That's correct. And the current statute for the education credit does not provide for any information about how credits are to be ordered. Now, sort of putting that in a little bit of perspective, the issue is some of the credits have a carryover and some, as the education credit, does not. And the reason that's important is because if you imagine you calculate your tax, and once you've calculated your tax, you've got to figure out how that tax is going to be paid. And if you've got a choice of a couple of credits, if it was in statute that the education credit basically had priority, then you would have sort of one result because you could carry over the other credit. If it was in statute that the other credit had priority, then you have the potential of losing the benefit of the education tax credit. It clearly depends on a taxpayer's circumstances, whether or not they have enough tax to absorb all the credits that they've got available. But I did want to at least bring it to the committee's attention, and I think that this was, Chairman, your question in the last committee meeting, when I answered it, it sort of necessitated talking briefly about ordering. and so I thought it might be helpful to prepare an example of the difference in the two scenarios. And this is true, too, of even any two credits that have a different carryover number of years. It's still a potential issue if you've got two credits that have a different carryover. I have just selected these three. Obviously, with the education credit is on the table. The gas exploration and development credit already in statute requires being applied first. And then I just picked the film production tax credit. It was recently enacted as an example of another carryover provision. So that's why I chose those credits here on the example. Does that help, Mr. Chairman?
It does. It does. I guess I'm just trying to figure out. It seems like these are complex taxpayers that it would be getting these credits, and I'm trying to figure out if there's any benefit for us in statute mandating that all taxpayers apply credits in a certain way, or these taxpayers that have their own very deft accountants and all. I mean, those are the people that we are generally considering in this. So your recommendation for our consideration of this section, would you think that it would be advisable for us to try to figure out ordering among the various tax credits, or should that be just left up to the individual taxpayer to figure out what's best for their situation?
Our suggestion would be to encourage the committee to consider putting in a provision. Now, on attachment 6, I've made a suggestion of what I believe is a pretty simple addition to the bill.
Now,
that would simply clarify the priority, but certainly it is a policy call.
We've got double-sided copies here, so we're kind of flipping back and forth a little bit. So we're talking about attachment 6. It's labeled at the top left-hand corner of the page.
Correct.
The others were labeled there at the bottom. So, and you are saying that...
So the suggestion there is the top suggestion, simply defining tax due under this chapter. And this suggestion would then apply the education credit as the next priority.
Okay.
And certainly with the current level of the education tax credit, it's not such an issue, but certainly if the education credit is bumped up quite a bit, then I think the issue becomes more apparent.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're saying that, I think I heard a soft recommendation for this change, and the beneficiary of that would be education in general. If I'm right, can you help us understand what the individual taxpayer might say if they were there, were here? I don't know that we have anybody here to testify.
Through the chair, it would certainly depend on the taxpayer's circumstances. If they intended to make an education contribution, whether or not they had considered other credits, I think it really is specifically about the individual taxpayer. It is helpful, I think, though, to have it clear as to the legislature's intent.
And Robin, so with this amendment, that would mean it would be in all the circumstances that you can envision, it would probably be to the benefit of incentivizing the use of the tax credit. Is that what?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I believe this would be a taxpayer-friendly amendment. and it does provide clarity for the administration of the tax.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Representative Keller, did you have a follow-up on that?
No, not for the department.
Okay. Robin, do you have...
Chair.
Oh, wait a minute. We have Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Robin. I think I understand what's happening here, but I just want to have you confirm it. This is on a slightly different matter, but Section 1 of the bill is drafted under the insurance statutes. And is that simply because the taxpayer statutes, the insurance is the first one?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes. As I understand, the education credit initially was drafted to apply to all the taxes, and certainly the insurance provisions are first in the statutes under Title 21.
Thank you.
And then the successive, all the different tax, the tax chapters in Title 43 follow that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Under attachment number one, under the assumptions at the very bottom, it says company does all of its business in Alaska. Is that just sort of a side note, or is that a requirement, hard and fast requirement?
Through the chair, it's not a requirement. It's just simply an assumption for this example. And I had considered giving you an example where the taxpayer does business in multiple jurisdictions, and it just seemed to get a little too complicated. But I think the overall idea is that taxpayers that do business in multiple jurisdictions, that is Alaska and other states, for example, Alaska taxes a piece of their income. So the benefit of a deduction actually is lower. So in that case, then the point of attachment one just sort of is even stronger, that the benefit of a credit is more valuable than the benefit of a deduction.
Follow up, Representative Edgman?
On a different page, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, just a minute. While we're on this point, does anybody have any questions about that? Oh, okay. Representative Edgman?
On attachment four, very quickly, I'm just curious why the fisheries resource landing tax has gone down so precipitously and, from FY08 to FY09. Any quick...
Between 7 and 8, too.
Through the chair, I don't know.
Okay. I can follow up on that independent of the committee.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could go back to attachment six. I'm being dense this morning, but the first suggestion you're making is I just want to confirm that right now the taxpayer, individual taxpayer, has the choice of prioritizing the education tax credit or one of the other ones. I mean, it's their option right now, right? So the benefit to clarifying the law, is that a benefit because there's an ambiguity in the law, or is that a benefit to the education system?
Through the chair, it is certainly an ambiguity in the system, and as to whether it would be a benefit to the education system, it seems to me it would be, but again, it is a policy call, and I have presented, you know, two examples where the priority is different on attachments 2 and 3, and suggested then the language based on an education credit being the priority.
Thank you, Robin.
Mm-hmm. And Robin, a clarification on that is, could we be looking at the circumstance in which a complex taxpayer that would be applying for different credits or could actually run into problems in the future because the interpretation of the Department of Revenue might be that the tax credits were applied in a different order than the taxpayer might desire, and this fully shows that with this ordering, the division, Department of Revenue would for sure allow this in the future? Is that where we're coming from?
Mr. Chair, if it's clarified in statute, then it becomes very clear for everyone. At this point, I just don't know what the intent was, and as credits are added to the statute, it becomes more problematic.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson, I'm focusing on the distinction between deductions and credits, and looking at the bill, the language of the bill, it seems like credit is pretty consistent throughout, and yet I think I understand that taxpayers have a choice between the two. So can you just show us in statute where that choice exists, number one, and then number two, at the federal level for charitable contributions, are those credits or deductions?
Yes, certainly, through the chair, Representative Gardner, just a moment. The choice of the taxpayer to claim a credit or a deduction, I would refer you to 4320.014D2. And what that says is a contribution claimed as a credit under this section may not also be allowed as a deduction under 26 U.S.C. 170 against the tax imposed by this chapter. What that means is, sort of to give a little bit of background, Alaska bases its tax on corporations starting with the federal taxable income. And so you start with the federal return with some modifications and then calculate our Alaska tax based on that. And so 26 U.S.C. 170 is the site of the Internal Revenue Code that allows the charitable contribution. And so this section is saying if you claim a credit, you can't also claim a deduction. The implication, of course, is that you could choose to claim the deduction. You just have to understand you're not going to get a credit.
Thanks.
And I apologize, Representative Gardner, through the chair. That was part one of your question. Could you repeat part two?
It's very complicated. I'm not sure I can. I wanted to know, under federal statute, do charitable donations earn a donation, earn a credit or a deduction? And
yes,
then I wanted to know in our statutes where that choice is, which you've answered.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Gardner, thank you. Yes, under the federal code, charitable donations have a tax deduction benefit, just like on your personal income tax return. There's no federal credit for charitable contributions.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Boop.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was wondering, is this the first time that we have aligned priorities like that as far as the tax history of Alaska?
Through the chair, no, sir, it is not, because 4320043, which is the gas development and exploration credit, that specifies that it will be applied first. And it's, for what it's worth, it's common under the federal code that, you know, the Congress has been very specific about which credits go first within their scheme.
Thank you.
Are there further questions? Thank you for preparing those charts of the past ones as well. And Robin, there's another recommendation on attachment 6. Would
yes,
you
thank you
go over that?
Yes, that was going to be my next suggestion here. The current statute basically says that a taxpayer can't claim more than $150,000 in credit for the education tax credit. And that's true within income tax and also specifically in comparison to other taxes. So if a taxpayer, for example, was subject to the corporate income tax and the fisheries business tax, the statute says that that taxpayer can't get more than 150,000 credit, and the taxpayer can apply it wherever the taxpayer sees fit. Between the corporate tax, could apply all to the corporate tax, all to the fish tax, or some combination thereof. The problem, though, is that the definition of taxpayer, that's fundamentally the problem. If we look first just within the corporate income tax, let us say that there's a big oil company that does business in Alaska. What we would expect to see would be that big oil company actually is a number of companies doing business in Alaska, that there would be big oil pipeline company, big oil exploration and production company, perhaps big oil marketing company. And those corporations commonly file together in one tax return. And based on the hearing minutes from when the education credit was initially enacted, the hearing minutes show that the intention was to give one $150,000 credit to that big oil company. But the definition of taxpayer in the statute refers to the individual corporation. So the ambiguity within the statute right now is, does that big oil company get $150,000 credit or three $150,000 credits? Complicating that is, there's also the possibility of, in that scenario where we have three corporations doing business here, it's also possible that two of them would file a consolidated tax return and one would file a separate one. And then you're also left with the question of, do they get one credit or two? That's just the corporate income tax. Now, if we consider a corporate group that does business subject to the fisheries business tax, for example, the definition of taxpayer is slightly different in the fisheries business tax area. And so there is a real danger of, just because there's an ambiguity here, of multiple tax credits being claimed and therefore granted without clarity in the statute, that it really means one credit. If that truly continues to be the legislature's intent. And so what I have, I provided a suggestion here that sort of focuses on the affiliated group. And what that means is, if you've got, for example, a big oil company with three sister companies, that the credit is granted with respect to that affiliated group. And then also, that could be applied to the other tax types, and we would look at the group of taxpayers that are related.
Okay, thank you, Robin. I think we understand. I guess I'm looking at the bill. Do you have the e-draft there by any chance?
Yes, I do.
On page 5, I think this is where we're talking about section 9. 43-2004-014-D.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between the wording on small 3 that we have in the 2. One has added words, contributions that are the basis for credits, and the wording that you have is combined with credits. Is there a distinction? That's the old language without this.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, certainly I did just utilize the language that's currently in statute now. I did not take into account what you have added there in the bill. Now, the words contributions that are the basis for My understanding is that does not change the meaning of it at all. It's, I think, just more grammatically correct and a clear statement of what was already in statute. So my suggestion here is I would draw your attention just to the last sentence of my suggestion there in bold, underlined, and that too is clearly $150,000 based on the current statute. And so if the credit is increased, then the appropriate number should go in place of the $150,000.
Okay, I just wanted to check and make sure that that's what we were talking about. And you from revenues aspect, I just want to make sure I understood, have no problems with the addition of contributions that are the basis for language in the first of that subsection 3.
Correct. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, I would just point out I'm looking at attachment 6 now. Under the bold underlined, it says add a new paragraph, and that simply defines affiliated group to be the related taxpayers, and that language is already in statute at 4320073. So I've just duplicated the language there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for working on this section and giving us suggestions of where we might run into further problems. Are there further questions or clarifications that anyone wants from Ms. Wilson?
I just have one.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Robin. Is your suggested amendment just in that one section that we just discussed, section 9 on page 5, or are there additional parts, locations in the bill where that needs to be clarified?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Munoz, at the bottom of attachment 6, I've suggested that similar language to be added in the respective sections. That would be sort of a drafting conformance, I believe.
Okay.
And I think that if we, Representative Munoz, if we decide to do this, we can do it as a conceptual amendment to the current language that we have, and just adding the bold language and then the new paragraph and the similar language. If we do that, then we won't have to be changing any language from the draft we're working on in sub 3. Are there further? Yes, Representative Keller.
Could I move that as a conceptual amendment? You just stated so well.
You sure may. We have a motion to move conceptual amendment number. This is one conceptual number one to version E, and that is on page 5, starting on line 26 or 7. The language that we have written here is adding, if the taxpayer is a member of an affiliated group, the credit may not exceed $25 million for the affiliated group. And then also defining affiliated group in a new section, and the drafter will put that in the correct spot, which is AS 4320014E3, affiliated group means a group of two or more corporations in which 50% or more of the voting stock of each member of the group is directly or indirectly owned by one or more corporate or non-corporate common owners, or by one or more of the members of the group. And then similarly, putting this language into the other provisions of the other taxes to which the credit would apply. Was that your amendment, Representative Keller?
That was. Just a clarification, it's exactly as worded on the attachment 6, except that after the word with in the first line there after 3 is what you suggested is contributions. that are the basis for credits taken, and then the change from the $150,000 to the $25 million, and otherwise it's there in print.
Thank you. And what, and that would be the wording that's currently in version E that as well. So is there any question about what we're talking about here? Representative Edgemond?
No, I'll hold.
Do you want to, does anybody want to object?
You repeat what he just did.
For discussion?
It was real quick what he did.
So we have conceptual amendment number one. Seeing no, no objection, that's adopted, but I will reference it as the written language in the discussion we've just proceeded with, adding the affiliated group provision to this, then the definition to all the tax forms. So that has passed and been adopted. Are there further questions? We have another question here, and that was a recommendation was for us to consider whether we wanted to clarify for revenue and for taxpayers that that paragraph that was suggested above. I'll just move. This is a conceptual amendment number two. AS 43020.014E2. A tax due under this chapter means a tax liability after application of the credit under AS 4320043 and before application of any other credits allowable under this chapter. And if that is needs to be repeated throughout for the bill for clarity for the other sections. And objection. Representative Keller objected. Would you like to speak to your objection, Representative Keller?
It's not a sure objection. It's just that I don't think we have enough information. The way it is now, as I understand it, there's a choice there. I'd like to leave that choice there and until I understand from a little bit more. So I'd just rather not go here.
And Representative Keller, that was my initial question, and then I think that because I had that same trepidation of what we were doing, but I can also see that future revenue officers and commissioners could change the usefulness of the tax credit by interpreting this ambiguity that this was adopted later than other tax credits, and other tax credits have to be applied first, and therefore we could have a situation in which a taxpayer is wanting to make a contribution, makes a contribution, assuming that they're going to get what we've specified, but revenue would make them apply other credits first and lessening the anticipated value of this tax credit. And so that's why I've become more comfortable with this ordering. Representative Keller.
In response to that, I thought of that too, but I was thinking that would probably suffice if we state our intent that it is the choice of the industry how they apply their tax credits. And it certainly is mine, but if if that's on the record, I would think that that would be sufficient at this point. And if somebody in the industry wanted to go a step further, this does have another committee, and I think it could be handled there.
Other questions, Representative Munoz?
On the amendment itself?
On the amendment itself, yes.
I guess I want to just sort of echo the previous comments that just very generally on to pertain to the amendment that this bill on the surface pretty simple bill, but once you start getting into the details, it's not a simple bill, and the implications are very far-reaching to some extent, to the point where I'm not sure. We had 11 hearings on the governor's scholarship bill. We really dug into that thing. This bill right here is going to require at least a few more hearings before I can really know what this means, and given it, it would go out of this committee in concert with a great number, not a great number, but a few other tax credit bills that you and I are working on a different committee. And so I'm trying to catch up here and keep up with what this bill is, you know, what the impacts are of all these credits and deductions.
Representative Keller, do you mind if I ask Robin Wilson's question? Yeah, normally we're under committee discussion, but I just want to. Robin, are you still online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
You've heard our discussion, and it was kind of along the lines of the first question I asked you, and are there unintended consequences to, or can you give me the consequences of us either adopting or not adopting this this amendment that we have before us, as far as, you know, ongoing, what would happen now and in the future? Can you just give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Chairman. Again, this is Robin Wilson with the Tax Division. This would give us, the department, clear guidance for writing regulations and even preparing the tax return form itself. It would maximize the credit usage for the education credit, if this is the direction the committee chose to go. I think that clearing up the ambiguity is the biggest benefit. And I am not aware of a downside.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. This is on a different subject, if you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
We have a conceptual amendment before us, and we have an objection. So, is there further discussion on conceptual amendment number one? And of course, if taxpayers, as it goes through the process, if taxpayers came along and said they didn't like it, they could always ask to have it deleted from a future reference as well. So, I guess just wrapping up, my concern is if we've got the department going to write regulations and there's ambiguities and they would prefer to have a little more direction, and if we don't see an industry downside, my preference would be to put it in, and if industry comes forward and says take it out, they could do that at a further hearing. I mean, somebody else will have control of the bill there. So, Representative Keller?
Respectfully, I'm going to maintain my objection, because the I think it could be made not ambiguous different ways. We could say we intend for the industry to have a choice. That'd be to remove the ambiguity, too. Can I just,
sure.
I'll maintain the objection.
Is there any other discussion on conceptual amendment number two, which is adding a new paragraph? And that is AS 4320041E2. Tax due under this chapter means tax liability after application of the credit under AS 4320043 and before application of any other credits allowable under this chapter. I'm going to go back to Ms. Wilson for just a moment. Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Does that wording need to be also have similar language added to the other sections of the bill? Or was that only for the affiliated group conceptual language that we put in?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that certainly the affiliated group would be applicable to the other sections. I'm not sure what other credits would apply, if any, on the other sections.
Okay, so we'll leave it this way, and so that's the conceptual amendment number two. Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Conceptual amendment two to HB 397. Representative Wilson is absent. Representative Edgman.
Pass.
I want to interrupt and go back. Is this 397 or 367? the bill that we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Amendment 2 to HB 367.
So would you void that roll and call another?
And Representative Wilson is absent. Representative Edgman.
I'm going to pass.
Representative Keller.
No.
Representative Booth.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
I have four yeas, two nays.
What?
Would you check and count that again?
I pat.
You counted Wilson.
Oh, did you?
You counted.
No. I passed the first time, then I was yes the second time. Okay. Yeah. So that might have been the confusion.
So I do have you as a yes before. I have Representative Fluke as a yay, Representative Munoz as a yay, Representative Edgman as a yay, Representative Keller as an, I'm sorry, Representative Chair Seaton as a yay. I have Representative Gardner as a nay.
Yes.
Oh.
No. Would you void that, and we'll do it again.
In light of time, I'll just remove my objection.
Okay. So. Let's press on. Thank you. So the objection.
Objection removing.
The objection to conceptual amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. So conceptual amendment number 2 to AS 4320041E2 has been adopted. Do we have further amendments at this time? Discussion? And Representative Edgman, did you... I'm not sure if your discussion was for the during the amendment, or you're wanting to discuss the bill, or
well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's your intent or the committee's intent to move this out today, and certainly I guess I'd have my opinion on that. But I apologize to the bill sponsor; I wasn't here during the first hearing, so I'm catching up here in terms of understanding the overall impact of the bill. But I'm just still. You know, sitting here with some questions about what it actually means. I support the concept. I think it's very worthwhile. But you know what it actually means in terms of its fiscal impact. And boy, it'd be interesting to see who over at the Department of Revenue is keeping a running tally of all these bills that we have going through the legislature with taxes and credits and so forth. You know, if it's the chair's intent, I'll. Certainly vote the way I need to vote, and then we just move on. But I don't feel like I have a full understanding of the fiscal impacts of this legislation at this point.
And thank you. And I think that we do have the fiscal note, but I...
Indeterminate.
Yeah, we don't know.
Indeterminate, because we don't know who will do what, and all we do is have a maximum amount. Representative Booth.
Mr. Chairman, all due respect to the... work that's been done and the sponsor of this, I feel the same way. I would like to have some more time myself to have the confidence that what we're doing here is moving in the right direction for the right purpose. So I would like to have at least another hearing on this where I would have time for an interim to study and to ask some questions myself with those folks in revenue. About this.
Very good. We have a couple members at least that would like to have another hearing. I think that we don't have to worry about things going rapidly through the process in House Finance anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I think they have a couple stacked up, and that would also give notice to the industry to have time to come back, and if they would like us to rescind an action of adopting that conceptual amendment we did. That would give Representative Keller a chance to talk to folks if and find out, either gain comfort level there or convince us that to remove that, and the sponsor is agreeable as well. And so what we're going to do is set this bill aside, and we will bring it up in the near future. And but let's make sure that everybody takes time to look over the implications and contacts folks that might be wanting to take advantage of this, and see whether those benefits to education are something we want to proceed with. So we'll set this bill aside for now, and we have House Bill 206, our friend from long duration and shorter. So we have 206 before us, not to move today. And remember, just reminding everybody that 206 is much shorter than it used to be. House Bill 206 now can consists of Section 1, and on the P version, it is through line 14. And we asked some questions of assessments. We were talking about, this is the work keys section that we have in here, and the department has provided us some materials and are here for discussion. So, Les, would you put yourself on the record, and we'll proceed with a...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gardner.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Can you refresh my memory about whether or not we have any amendment relating to the high school graduation qualifying exam on the table, passed or failed?
We have conceptual amendment number 7 was to remove, and I believe it passed 5-2.
Okay.
Is
thank you.
And the secretary, that's, is that correct? Yes. Conceptual amendment number 7 did pass 5.
I just couldn't remember the status.
Thank you. Les, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Les Morris. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education and Early Development. What I'd like to do is address there were 3 questions around the work keys that were asked. There was also some issues that came up during the previous testimony on this and previous hearing on this regarding which grade level the work keys would be most appropriate, some questions about transcripts versus CUM records. And then I wanted to make about 4 points related to the high school graduation qualifying exam without going too deep into that, but just some high-level points regarding that. So if I may, the first issue I'd like to address, it was from the last hearing around the discussion for 11th or 12th grade giving the exam. And to me, it comes down there to a question regarding who's the exam for. Is it for adults making decisions about where a student might best fit into an employment situation, or is it for a student to prepare for what they want to do next? And it seems to make sense to the department, the board, and also from my perspective of working with students, that giving the test in 11th grade gives that student yet an opportunity to really think about what they might do in their 12th grade year differently before they graduate. And that doesn't prohibit them from then again taking the test, but it seems to make sense that the requirement lie in 11th grade. And so that's why we took that position, is it gives information to the student to do something and change their behaviors in their final year. Hopefully then they're motivated either by that test or perhaps by that test in combination with an ACT or an SAT. So I just wanted to address that. The second issue I'd like
before you go on, and let's stop and have a discussion on these points as we go, because this is we're not planning to move this bill, so at this time anyway. We were just talking about that if we were going to have the requirement that shows on the transcript, I mean if that's what we're doing, then it could be taken a second time. What is the cost, or would that be done through, did we find out from the Department of Labor?
No.
Okay. the Department of Labor offers work keys. And so if work keys was taken through the Department of Labor as a senior, if they wanted to upgrade their score, would that be something that would be, could the school system accept those levels of testing and have that on the transcript, or does the work keys test have to be administered through the school itself?
Chair Seaton, I am not positive about that answer, but let me give you some. We certainly would have to work with Department of Labor and check that, and work with our any agreements we have between Department of Labor that are on the record already through an MOU, and I don't know that we have one for sharing data in that area. We share other data with them, so I don't know that that would be a problem. Likely, we'd have to get the data and give it to the district from Department of Labor, and I just don't know if we have mechanisms set up for that. I also believe the student could take the test again in their 12th grade year in the school system if we set that mechanism in place, but I think the way that our regulations read currently is that if they're taking it the second time, they can be charged, the student can be charged, but I think it's a fairly low cost behind it. And again, we can clarify that and get you an answer regarding that so that.
Yes, if you do that and let us know what those, you know, what that fee or what currently is anyway.
Do that.
Thanks.
If I may then continue, another issue that arose at the last hearing and discussion on this was just transcripts versus CUME records and how they interrelate, and I wanted to address that. That all of the assessments that are state-wide assessments given to students, there's a requirement that the results of those be placed in the CUME record, which is a file of all the students' performances in their school period. And that's there for the purposes of it provides a good background information for educators who are trying to think about what do we need to do with this particular student. That is different than a transcript.
Is that accurate?
The transcript is typically a summary of one time frame. So there's a high school transcript that's a record of all the high school courses that a student takes, oftentimes has their attendance on it, and it, under current regulation, they're required to place the HSGQE results on the transcript as well.
Okay, I just meant there was a question.
Yeah, you mentioned, Les, transcripts versus CUME. Is that short for cumulative?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, that I'm sorry for my CUME in a school as the CUME record. So yeah, I meant the cumulative record, which is really a cumulative file of all their performances during their schooling experience.
Okay, that's what I thought.
A child or a student's schooling experience.
Okay, and so going back to, we had this, it was, the assessment was going to be on the high school transcript. You're saying that the score of the high school qualifying exam is on the transcript?
Chair Seaton, right now the district is required to place the score as to whether the student passed or did not pass that exam. That's the only assessment that we require currently on the transcript. And there is a burden. I can't speak to how big the burden is to a district to put those things on, because it's usually a management record keeping system that brings that information in to their student records, and then it is on their transcript.
Just that they passed, though, not a score on.
Through the Chair Seaton, that's correct. It just indicates that they passed or did not pass the high school graduation qualifying exam, and it usually is electronically placed there on most transcripts. They're seldom done by hand anywhere.
Representative Keller.
This is a question for the chair. The work keys, there is no indication on the diploma as far as any level of, you know, related to the work he's on the diploma, right? Or is there?
Actually, we had a big debate about that that I lost. It's not on the diploma, it's on the transcript, but it is, yes, it says on line 14, the assessment shall be displayed in summary form on the student's high school transcript. So
That helps. I was going to that meeting, and thank you for clarifying that. Yeah.
Okay. Where we have the use of a transcript, now is that, let's say an employer is out there wanting to employ somebody, is that the record that if they wanted to get it so that they would know the level of preparedness that the student is, they would request, or the student would request the transcript and then it would get sent to the employer? Is that the way this all works?
Yeah, Chair Seaton, typically what happens is if an employer wanted to see a student's high school performance, the best summary document to see that is going to be a transcript. That's the most universal tool used. They could ask a student if they've also taken the work keys and ask for those work keys results also to be submitted to them as an employer, which if the student no longer had that, they would always be able to go to their secondary school and get that because it would be in their CUM record, which is a public document and has it's in a retention record, and I don't remember the number of years, but I think it is on the virgin, the area of 70 years, I believe, that those high school records have to remain retained by a district.
And a question there, when you're talking with Department of Labor, would you find out whether there's I'm thinking of employers who are often not wanting to see all the transcript of all the classes that a kid took in high school, but they want to know if they want to know their assessments on work keys and where they qualified. Is there any interaction between those score work keys certificate levels with the Department of Labor? Or whether that could be accomplished in any way voluntarily by the student or some kind of MOU so that the students could, you know, work with the Department of Labor and have those forwarded to Department of Labor so they'd be available there as well. And I'm not asking for an answer right now. I'm asking for you to, while you're talking with the Department of Labor, see if there's some way that, because what we're trying to do is make the high school graduation means something. We're trying to have those things meaningful, but if the only way is for somebody to order a $10 or $15 transcript and have the whole record of his high school freshman PE class show up to the employer, that doesn't seem to be the issue.
Chair Singh, let me clarify that. Really, a transcript is a one-page document. That's all it is. It tells what course they took, what grade they had. And sometimes it might be front and back, but I worked at Juno Douglas High School for many years, and most of the information fits on front page. Literally, it is truly a summary document of their high school performance. It would tell you their grades by semester, usually some attendance information, whether they graduated, and then their high school pass or fail marks. And so, and typically, the only way a transcript can be sent and is by a student making a request to a registrar's office, or the student getting a certified copy that they deliver from their registrar's office. I don't know that registrars typically forward things to businesses, but they do to universities at the request of a student. So it is a nice summary document.
Right, and we're just looking at trying to make the diploma more useful and accessible, and so whether that is a transcript and if that's the proper way, or if there's some way that we need to change this so that it's not just on the transcript but the levels of work keys can be forwarded from, you know, as a separate item without all the transcript information to an employer we may need to put that in. So I'd appreciate it if you and Department of Labor could help us figure out if there's a better way for us to make that information available at the student's request, of course, to the employer. Yes, Representative Keller.
As I'm looking and thinking about this, it says that it displayed in summary form, and I was wondering if you would describe what you envision of the summary form on the transcript. I'm assuming that this is going to be something that the, I mean, obviously something the districts are going to have to come up with, but that they aren't coming up with now. And would it be any big burden to add the requirement that contact or information about how to get the full report? You know, so that's part of the summary. You know, I mean, that shouldn't be any big deal, right? Because you said it's really easily accessed, and it seems like that would raise a value to the transcript. If I was to looking to employ a student, and it gave me a summary of his results on WorkKeys, and then information about where to get the full report on the WorkKeys test, you know, that'd be pretty good information, I would think.
Through the chair, Representative Keller. In my view, summary information would be what level did they obtain on the different tests. So in math, they obtained a bronze, silver, gold. That, to me, is the summary information. It might be possible to add a line on there, full record can be requested from registrar's office or from student. I think the student will have to give permission for that, any of their records to be moved anywhere. That's under their federal rights, under the federal law. So hopefully that's what I'd view as summary information. And to speak to the cost of it, I really can't speak to that. Districts would have to talk about what it would take in terms of programming. I just don't have that kind of information. It's not something that we deal with in their software systems that they use for their transcripts.
And we have a finance director here, so we can get him up here so he make sure that carpet gets worn out between his seat and office.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think we're making things a little bit more complicated than they need to be. A diploma is simply a document that says you've met the graduation requirements. Whatever they might be in statute, you've met them. The transcript has your grades, your attendance record, and I would anticipate if we decide to require work keys, it would have your work keys score or score level. I mean, that is, I've never encountered, and I don't know that my kids ever have, or I don't know of anybody ever, any employer or educational institution needing more information than that to know.
Uh-oh.
Bertha, that was it.
It wasn't that controversial.
You had to do it, didn't you?
Oh, well, you did it now.
Wait, it stopped.
Oh, good. Okay. We are now back on the record after a fire alarm and evacuations and all those things. Mr. Morris, would you go ahead and continue?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is make sure I address your questions and then just talk a little bit about the HSGQE relative to the work keys. First off, let me start by indicating, actually I want to go back and clarify something before I do that on that we were previously speaking of. I had a chance during the fire alarm to review our regulation that we currently have on the books for students to repeat the exam. And if a student improves their score, so if they take it their 11th grade year, retake it in their 12th grade year, student improves their score, there's no charge to the student or the district for that. If they don't improve their score, there can be a charge that's worked out whether the district or the student would pay that. So when there's improvement, there is no, the costs are either incurred by the state or the vendor in some fashion, according to the reg. So I just wanted to clarify that. The next piece of just talking about how this lines out with the HSGQE, I think from the department's perspective, from the state board's perspective also, the state board's supportive of keeping the high school qualifying exam in place at this time. Not that we ought not look at something different down the road, but they think it's important to take a better comprehensive view of our comprehensive assessment system and our accountability system and not be changing pieces at the moment. And there is a lot of things occurring, not just at the state level, which frankly is where we want to focus our energy, but we also want to make sure what we do is compliant with the federal level. And there are some potential changes coming within the next year that we don't want to be out of sync and have to have a federal and a state accountability system, two separate things necessarily. So their position is that it is accomplishing a goal of making sure kids graduate with a minimum set of skills, and that at this time we ought to keep it in place, but some further look at it would be valuable. Let me also say that I think it's important to sort of have, from our perspective, that the work keys be a separate issue than that. And the reason is they really fulfill two different purposes. The HSGQE tests are state content standards. And I asked to have a document provided to you, which I believe you have, and it's titled the HSGQE Proficiency Descriptors and Work Keys Skill Levels. I've gone over this before, so I didn't ask to have this in front of you to go over it in detail again, because it was at a previous committee. But I thought it was important just to show you that there are skills that are covered on one and not the other, and vice versa, and that they do cover different things. Also, just to remind you of the different levels, which is on the front page. So that was the purpose in providing this to you. What I think is important is that the work keys can be a very good test for information, but it would be very difficult, and I would be incredibly reluctant to ever use the work keys or any other commercial product as a high-stakes individual student test. So if you wanted to replace it to be high stakes, we'd be very reluctant. And the reason I'd be reluctant to do that is when you give a high-stakes student test to a student that is going to deny them potentially their diploma. If it's a vendor product, you can't use rules that you decide in the state to use. You have to use that vendor's rules, particularly accommodations for students with special education. And let me give you an example. Yesterday I learned that signing, something we clearly allow on all of our state-developed tests, is not allowed on the work keys. I was actually rather surprised it wasn't allowed. It didn't make any sense to me.
And you're talking about American Sign Language or?
Chair Seaton, that's correct.
Okay.
Now, the presumption is someone who can't hear should be able to read, but signing is something that's frequently used. So that goes through with all of the test accommodations where we'd have to use the vendor product. So I'd keep, you know, work keys is a good informational tool. I wouldn't consider using it as a high stakes tool. I would never consider using any vendor product as a high stakes tool. A couple other things I just wanted to mention about the HSGQE. Well, actually, let me shift and make sure I answer your questions that came up. And actually, that was one of the questions that you had asked around that. But the other one that came up from the last hearing was some more analysis around the certification levels of the work keys and the equivalent to the HSGQE. We've tried to take a look at students who took the work keys in their 11th grade year and what their score was back when they took the HSGQE in their 10th grade year, to say, do students who score a certain level, bronze, silver, gold, or platinum on the work keys, how do they score relative to the HSGQE? And what we did is enough information to tell you when I get more students, I could do that kind of analysis at a more sophisticated level. Right now, we only have enough students where we could make an exact match of about 390 students. And that's not enough to make a judgment of gold means they would have passed the HSGQE. But generally, we found students in that small group that passed, that got a silver or a gold or higher, if they got that level on work keys, they also passed the HSGQE. Typically, kids who got a bronze level, some of them did not pass the HSGQE. But again, the student population we looked at was simply too small for us to say we could do that. But next year, when we give it to the whole population, and we can backtrack that to their HSGQE, we'll be able to provide you that kind of analysis.
And you're planning on doing that?
We Chair Seaton, we're able to, we have all the data when they take that test now that we'll easily be able to do that. And that, yes, that will be
okay,
possible.
Yeah, because we would like to ask you for a report on that.
Yeah, that can be done. The other question that was asked is there anything missing? If we wanted to, and again, let's say you took away the high stakes nature of the HSGQE, but you wanted to make sure work keys tested the same content areas. There is one content test in work keys that we are not giving, that on the HSGQE we test those types of skills, which is in writing. Currently we do some subtests that get at reading for information, reading and math, but there is a open-ended writing component and some grammar writing issues on the language arts test of the HSGQE that are not covered in work keys. Now keep in mind, even when if we did incorporate writing, there are some detailed skills, as are outlined on that document I earlier referred to, that you can go through and see. There are things that we still won't be testing that are on our standards, but at the same token, if you want to include all content areas, that would have to be changed. And it's also something that the state board could go back into their regs and make a change at that level, regardless of the statute, if you separated the HSGQE from the work keys. I want to make just a final couple of points around the high school qualifying exam in terms of putting some data in front of you, because the question came up about, well, is the HSGQE really working? Well, you have to go back to what its original purpose was, but hopefully we prove more students, gain some basic skills, and graduate with those basic skills. And since the first year that it was put in place for all students, which was 2005, more students are graduating today than they were at that time. We've gone from a 61.4% graduation rate to this past year a 67.5% graduation rate. Also during that time, our special education population graduation has improved. While slight, it has improved. It's gone from 39.6 to 43.6. That's not good enough. We need to do better, but it is improving during that time frame. Another couple of points that I think are worthy is, what is it, those kids that get to the 12th.
Representative Gardner.
I'm sorry, I just have to ask you, is there any reason to think that it's the high school graduation qualifying exam that has made these slight or significant improvements? I mean, there are a lot of other things going on as well, mm-hmm. and it may just be incidental that it's the exam.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we don't have any study or anything that we could pinpoint it to that. There are a lot of other, you are absolutely right, there's a lot of other improvement efforts in our standards-based movement that we've been moving forward for over 15 years. It could come from a number of things. However, if it were the reverse, we certainly would want to be looking into it, see, is this preventing kids from graduating? Couple other facts in terms of date. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I think we've heard testimony that it does. That's the element of the high stakes, that kids who otherwise meet the course requirements and haven't passed the high school graduation qualifying exam for whatever reason then do not graduate.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, if I could respond to that with a couple other facts uh-huh. that I think are worth hearing about. Mm-hmm. At the 12th grade level, now, again, some kids don't get to the 12th grade level. Why don't they get there? There's a number of reasons. But at the 12th grade level, we looked at the class of 2008 really quite carefully. And we have 270 students in the class of 2008 who did not graduate because they did not pass the high school qualifying exam. They met all their local requirements. 270. Also that year, though, there was 1,926 students in 12th grade that did not graduate but passed all parts of the exam. Hmm. And so their local requirements got in their way of graduation, not the high school qualifying exam. Again, I would just think those numbers are important. 270 didn't pass the exam and as a result didn't graduate. 1,926 passed all parts of the exam. They didn't graduate for another reason, which would have to be they didn't pass a local requirement. So,
Mr. Chair,
the majority of not those not passing actually are not graduating, are actually passing the exam. So they're meeting that minimum requirement, but hopefully districts have higher requirements, and that's what may, that's also holding them back at a much greater level than the exam.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. 1,926 passed the exam but didn't graduate because of local requirements, but couldn't there not be other reasons, such as the testimony we've heard about kids who say, I don't need to go to school anymore, I passed the exam?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I don't think that would be true of that population, because most of these probably passed the exam in 10th or 11th grade, and they were still appearing in school in their 12th grade year. Are there other students who might say that in their 10th or 11th grade? Possibly, but I don't have any data to back that up. I typically like to make decisions with hard data. I have no survey of numbers of students who actually leave because of that reason. I think that's probably few.
Yeah, Mr. Morris, did these students get a certificate of attendance?
Chair Seaton, they got what's called a certificate of achievement, and that means the 270 students got a certificate of achievement because they achieved their local standards or their local requirements but did not pass the high school qualifying exam. This 1,926, they did not receive, they didn't receive anything because they've got to pass your local requirements. And so they may have been students who come back the next year and work to finish out those requirements. But that particular year, they were 12th graders, did not graduate, but passed the three parts of the high school qualifying exam. And by the way, there were, just to give you another number, that year there were 2,787 seniors, 12th graders, who did not graduate. So this 1,926 represents 69.1% of that. So 69.1% of the students who were seniors but didn't graduate had passed all parts of the exam. Vast majority of them, nearly 70%.
Okay, and that's sometimes called the dropout population, but it may not be because some of those, we don't know what percentage of those students came back and did a fifth year, say a fifth year in high school or a summer semester or something. This is didn't graduate within that academic year. Is that right?
Chair Seaton, that's correct.
Okay, and I presume that you guys have all those student identifier numbers, and at some point in time you'll be, since you're doing this research, you'll be following up on those, and we'll be able to tell us what the outcome of that was. And if you do have a report on that, if you could send that to the committee, we'll distribute it. So,
yeah, absolutely, Chair Seaton, we can do that. It's important to note about dropouts that about a large number of dropouts, about 30% of students who drop out in 1 year, if that's the first year they drop out, come back again the next year, and then some of them drop out again. Nearly 20% of students drop out, have dropped out more than one time, so up to two times.
You want to just check with yes, your question? Representative Book.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Les, you brought up a couple of points, and you're probably not the one to answer this, but it's encouraging that we have enhanced our graduation, and you mentioned one in particular, special education, where we went from, I believe you said, 38 to 41 something,
mm-hmm.
And that was since 2005. Just in my experience in being on this committee in the last couple of years and the testimony that I've heard over that, I know that we really enhanced our investments on those people. And I was just wondering to the degree to which we did. I mean, I want to know how much we have invested on those in those people, because I know that has been a complaint that I've received through the teachers at the door, where they're saying that, you know, if they have just a couple special needs students in their classrooms, the investment that everybody makes, including the other students, is huge. and not just the cost, but I am curious as to how much or what percentage of our investment in education has been derived in that direction since 2005. And that may not be a question for you, but for the department.
Through the chair, Representative Book, in terms of total investment, I couldn't speak to that. I know there's an increase in funding, certainly, for all students. There's also an increase in funding for our intensive special education students. And many of those intensive special education students don't ever earn a diploma. So some of that investment may or may not be an impact on this. But overall, I think I can speak to the fact that we are providing, and districts are providing, better education to all teachers on how to work with all students, including in a classroom, if I have 30 students, two students who are special education walking into the door, I can tell you the training is more sophisticated, the information we have about how to help those students is much more sophisticated today than it was when I was a classroom teacher and had that situation. So. That has improved both with technical assistance from the state as well as federal level and other agencies, as well as the investment that the legislature has made in education.
Through the chair,
Reverend Booth.
I know. I understand. I'm concurring with that, and I'm encouraged by that. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what, you know, how the shift or the redirection in funding has gone. We've been spending more money on education every year, there's no question about that. But you know, there's also been, you know, in my estimation, the correct readjustments. I was just wondering as to know the percentages of that. That's all.
Les, did you have anything else?
No.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a request, if I may.
Yes.
Les, could we get a copy of an example of the exam, the high school qualifying exam?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I can easily give you what we call our item sampler. It gives you a very good feel for what kind of items are on the test, and it's every test concept that is tested on the test is represented there. So we'll get that sent to the committee.
What if we can't pass it?
I know, I was going to suggest maybe we should take it fast.
When we were doing that, we did. Just like some of us took the work keys.
It was hard.
thank you very much for coming. I think that was our question. We want to take back up House Bill 367 for a few minutes here at the end. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I am going to offer an amendment, conceptual amendment, to lower the tax credit amount in this bill from $25 million to $5 million. And if there's support, then I'll bring it back as a CS for a future discussion.
And what we will do is we had two other amendments we adopted today. So if we adopt this amendment, we will roll that into the CS that will work up for the entire bill. Is there, so the amendment was offered to, conceptual amendment to lower page 3, line 25, from $25 million to $5 million, and correspondingly throughout the other taxes in the bill. Representative Booth, objection for discussion.
Yes. And basically commentary, if me or my staff could be of assistance in this, or as far as getting more information or whatever, I'd be glad to join in your activities. I remove my objection.
Okay, objection is removed. Is there any other objection to conceptual amendment number 3? Isn't that where we are?
Yes.
Conceptual amendment number 3, lowering the maximum combined amount of credits to $5 million. Seeing none, conceptual amendment number 3 is adopted. Are there any other amendments at this time to come before the committee? Seeing none, we will put House Bill 367 aside and take it up at a future date. And thank you, the committee, and we will be adjourned at 10:02.